post-quantum phase transition. That means we need to know about conformal field theories. So I'll spend some time explaining the ADS-CFT and particle correspondence. Then I'll write down a slightly unusual effective action that will scare you at first. And then we'll do some calculations with the gauge interactions to reassure you that everything's fine still. And then the punchline at the end is I'll show you how you can measure critical exponents of Higgs at the LHC using Higgs interference experiments. Okay, so we found the Higgs, or something very much like the Standard Model Higgs. This is the most important particle physics discovery since the time of Rutherford. Rutherford knew about alpha, beta, gamma. We call those quarks, leptons, and gauge bosons. So since the time of Rutherford, we've just collected more examples, different types of quarks, different types of leptons, different types of gauge bosons. This is the first time we found directly something that's not one of those. This is the delta. So you look very excited. It's very exciting. This is the first new thing in your lifetime. There's a problem. The problem is that we've known since 1939 that the Standard Model doesn't work. Weisskopf calculated the mass of a scalar at one loop and found that the mass of a scalar goes like the cutoff. So we'll never find an elementary scalar particle. And just to remind you, we calculate loop corrections from the top, gauge bosons, Higgs self interaction, and now we've measured the mass so we can put in the numbers. And magically, when you put in the numbers to 32 decimal places, it's just these last few digits that determine that the Higgs mass is 125 GeV. So that's why we think the model is wrong. Maybe it's right, but naively, it looks unlikely that that's really how it works. And over the years, people have come up with various ideas to solve this, adding new physics. Savas was one of the pioneers. So supersymmetry technicolor composite Higgs, an experiment tells us that one of those is wrong, so we're only left with two possibilities, and I'm going to focus on composite Higgs stories today. So quantum phase transitions. First, let's start out with phase transitions. So you remember the Ising model. You have this fake plus or minus spin, and it has a nearest neighbor interaction. At low temperatures, all the spins will line up, either all plus or all minus. There's a broken symmetry since they're equivalent, but it'll pick one based on some historical accident. At high temperatures, it's all just random, so equal numbers of black and white squares here. As we lower the temperature down to the critical temperature, we still have an equal number of white and black squares just above the critical temperature, but what we see is the sizes of these clusters are getting bigger as we get closer to the critical temperature. So more precisely, what you'd say is there's a two-point function, spin correlator, it has an exponential decay with distance, and there's a correlation length. As you approach the critical temperature, this correlation length is diverging. In particle physics, we would translate that to say that there's an order parameter, it's associated with some scalar field. Scalar field has a mass that's approaching zero, and 1 over the correlation length is that mass. So there's a massless field at the critical point. So if you tune right to the critical point, then you get something a little more interesting. What you see is that you're getting some fractal behavior. So the correlation function falls off as a power law of distance. And this, you can think of this as a fractal dimension or a scaling dimension or a critical exponent. If we Fourier transform for the three-dimensional case, this is the critical exponent. So there's for these continuous phase transitions, there's two types of critical exponents. There are boring and interesting. Boring is called mean field theory, and interesting is called non-mean field theory. And so we'd like to find out, in our case, which one we're in. And now, quantum phase transitions. So here is a temperature axis. We know in the early history of the universe, temperature was much higher. at high temperatures, we were in some symmetric phase where the Higgs vanished. And at around 100 GeV in temperature, we went into a phase where the Higgs got a VeV, W's and Z's got masses, and it's an electroweak superconductor. So there's a Meissner effect that expels the W and Z fields, but since the VeV is everywhere, there's just W's and Z's can't propagate anywhere. Or in other words, there's a penetration depth for W's and Z's, which is 1 over their mass. So we're in the superconducting phase. For a general phase transition, there's always other parameters that you could vary, like there could be pressure, or for ordinary superconductors, there's doping. You add atoms of some different species, and by varying the amount of those, you can induce another phase transition. And the simplest thing that happens is that there's a phase transition line going from the pure temperature transition to the transition here. Now, down at this end, the temperature is zero. Usually, thermal fluctuations dominate what's going on at the phase transition, but if the temperature is zero, then you only have quantum fluctuations left over. So condensed matter people call the transition down here a quantum phase transition, and being right at this point is called the quantum critical point. Now, in the standard model, we are right there, close to the critical point. We're actually very, very close. So in the standard model, the parameter that fills in for P here is the mass term in the Lagrangian for the Higgs. And if I change, go out to 32 decimal places and change that number, then I move from one side of the phase transition to the other. So in the standard model, we are very, 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 very close to a quantum critical point. Now, I'm going to imagine that there's some new physics, but that we're still close to that quantum critical point. Maybe we're not as close, but we're still close because the Higgs is light. And if we're at a quantum critical point, at any point along this phase transition boundary, there's some mass that's approaching zero, and generally what you expect is there's interactions, something happens, and you go along some renormalization group flow, and eventually you'll get to some fixed point. It could be a trivial fixed point or an interacting fixed point. There'll be some fixed point, and there'll be some critical exponents or scaling dimensions that are associated with that fixed point. So in the standard model, it's a sort of trivial fixed point with just perturbative scaling dimensions. So that's the boring mean field theory case. But if there's new physics, then we could be at some interesting fixed point where there's non-trivial scaling dimensions. So the goal by the end of the talk is we want to see how we could A, parameterize such theories, and then compare to LHC experiments and extract out the critical exponents and see if they're boring mean field theory or something more interesting. Well, we need them to be below a TV if we're going to see them. But they don't have to be. They could. We'll see that there's a threshold that's above the Higgs mass. So we don't need anything lighter than the Higgs. OK, so that's the end of the beginning. I'm going to move on to conformal field theories now that we know why we were interested in conformal field theories. Any questions? So conformal field theories. Imagine you had an electron and a photon. They're massless, and they're going along the same direction. They're massless, so each of their p squareds is zero. But if you add up their momentum, that p squared is not zero. You could add another photon, and similarly, there's some non-zero p squared. Or you could add an electron and a positron pair, as long as they're all going the same direction. You can't distinguish these in this theory because there's no mass for the electron or positron. So all you see is something, blob of energy with charge 1 going off in this direction with some value of p squared. So in a CFT, there is no real concept of particles. What you have are things that look like jets. So when I say CFT, just imagine some theory of jets. At least for the phenomenologists, that's easier to imagine. I don't I see lots of non-phenomenologists imagine CFT when I say CFT. Okay, so typically, if these are interesting CFTs, they're strongly coupled, and phenomenologists don't know how to calculate anything. So then we cheat. We use ADS CFT. So thanks to Maldacena, we know that we have, if we have some fancy CFT and it has some operator O, and that's a gauge invariant operator of the CFT, and we want to calculate its, the partition function, so finite is a source for that operator. We can calculate that by writing down 5D gravity with a bulk 5D field whose takes a value on the boundary of finite. And then this boundary value of the bulk field is a source, acts as a source for our CFT operator, and we can calculate endpoint functions of our CFT operator. So this is one way to write the metric for five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. You can see that there's a scale invariance. If we rescale X and Z, the metric is can be left invariant, and that's how we map the conformal transformations onto isometries of the five-dimensional space. Everyone has seen this kind of thing, I hope, a million times, so I don't have to say anything more. Yes. So I'll say some more. To do an actual calculation, we have to cut off the boundary, so we don't let the space go all the way down to z equals 0. We cut it off at some position epsilon, and we write down our bulk action, and we usually leave it as quadratic because in the large n limit where this is all justified, interaction terms are suppressed by powers of n. Then, given this metric, we can just solve for the bulk equations of motion, and we find that the bulk field can be written in terms of some Bessel functions with an index. And if you look at rescaling, doing scaling transformations, you can see that the scaling of this has to be 4 minus the scaling of the CFT operator. So you can extract the scaling dimension of the CFT operator that the boundary value of this is the source for. And it's related to the index of this Bessel function, which is determined by this mass term. So the index is the square root of 4 plus m squared r squared, where r is the curvature radius. So now you've reparameterized your CFT, and the scaling dimensions are determined by these bulk masses. And then you can go on and calculate your endpoint functions. Now, even that is too much work for a phenomenologist, because you have 5 dimensions. And in the end, everything you want to calculate is only 4-dimensional. So it seems like you could just get rid of this extra dimension somehow and have some more compact way of calculating just in 4 dimensions. And that goes by the unfortunate name of unparticles. Howard has a unique sense of humor. So this is a different way to calculate in CFTs, again, that only uses 4-dimensional technology. His justification for the name was that if you look at the phase space of these things, it looks like a fractional number of particles, so a non-integer number of particles. And he likes to have jokey titles. That's the other justification. So here is how Howard would do the calculation of the two-point function. He said, here is our CFT operator. We calculate its two-point function, so it's Green's function, and we Fourier transform it to momentum space, and then we can just write down the answer. The answer is that you write down a spectral density representation. And usually there's some function rho of m squared here, so we're integrating over m squared. So here's a propagator, looks like a normal scalar propagator, but we integrate over the mass of that thing with some spectral density. That's always true, you can always do that. But here, we know the exact form of the spectral density. So it has to be scale invariant, and it has to match the dimensions of this expression above. So if the dimension of O dagger is 2 delta, then the power of m squared is fixed. So we need, there's dimension 2 delta from there, there's the 2 delta, there's dimension minus 4 from the d4x, there's the minus 4. and the rest is dimensionless. So that's the exact answer for our CFT, and we only needed 4 dimensions to calculate it. And then you can just explicitly do this integral, and you find that the propagator looks like some funny power of p with some convenient, this normalization is just chosen so that when delta goes to 1, this reduces to the normal propagator, and you can see that when delta is 1, this is 1 over p squared. So, and you'll trust me, these d's should have been deltas. Sorry, I changed notation. So the normalization doesn't matter anyway. What we care about is the scaling with p. So this is exactly equivalent to what you'd extract from ADS-CFT, and I'll show you that now, unless there's a question. So in our ADS-CFT language, we had this bulk field, and we needed its boundary value to act as a source. So there's some normalization, again, that we don't care about. Since we solved the bulk equations of motion, if we integrate by parts, we can plug that bulk equation of motion into the action, and the bulk part will vanish because we solved the equations of motion. But the integration by parts will leave us with a surface term because there's we have to move a derivative around, so we'll get derivative acting on the metric and the other part of the kinetic term. But it's a total derivative, so we can integrate it, and it's just a 4-dimensional thing on the boundary. So this is just boundary term. And so in general, the boundary term in momentum space is some quadratic form in the source with some function of momentum. And given that we extracted the bulk solutions, we can calculate what this function is. There's some constant term that's regulator dependent. Typically add a counter term to get rid of that because we don't care. The leading term is p to some funny power. And if you compare to Howard's answer, which was p to some funny power, then you find that delta turns out you can get plus or minus nu, just like ADS-CFT always told us. So for the plus case, this k function is the two-point function of the CFT operator. And you can see that because we differentiate with respect to the source. We pull down a k, and that's the two-point function of the CFT operator. So ADS-CFT agrees with unparticles. We're going to be interested in the case when the dimension is less than 2. So that there's a special trick for that due to Klebanov and Witten. You have to choose some different boundary conditions on the boundary. So the way they do that is to do a Legendre transformation, so introduce a new source for phi, and then solve for phi in terms of that source. So now A is the source, and the process of doing this means when you get it in terms of A, you now have K inverse. So you flip that P to the 2 nu. So now the dimension is, the scaling dimension of the field is 2 minus nu. And now A is the source, and it's the source for phi naught. So with this choice of boundary conditions, phi naught represents the CFT operator. And so the propagator of phi and the propagator of the CFT operator are the same. So K inverse is G. So the effective action for this guy is the inverse propagator in between the fields, like you'd expect. And so just to hammer it home, if we want the two-point function of some CFT operator, we take the functional derivative with respect to the sources, and we get Howard's answer. So now we have 3 ways to calculate two-point functions of CFT operators. And you can choose whichever one you want. You can do some non-perturbative calculation in the CFT. No one chooses that. You can choose ADS. Most people choose that. Or you can choose this 4-dimensional language, which is the easiest, and very few people choose that. So just to summarize this section, I have a dictionary you can translate for ADS-CFT unparticle correspondence. You can translate from Georgi language to string theorist language. So we'll start out with moose. Savas remembers the moose. I remember the moose. No one else remembers the moose. Howard was working on Technicolor, and he had to write models that had multiple gauge groups with fields that transformed under two gauge groups. So he invented this notation that a circle was a gauge group and a bifundamental was a line between two gauge groups. And then he could draw enormous diagrams of gauge groups that looked so elaborate they sort of looked like a moose after you drank some moose head beer, which was Howard's favorite beer. So string theorists later worked on the same exact same thing, but they said these are called quiver models. It sounds more mathematical, at least. But same things. String theorists have, when they perturb ADS, they add things called double trace perturbations. So you have a trace, gauge invariant trace of an operator times gauge invariant trace of an operator. So it's a product of two gauge invariants. So if we translate that, if we translate that to Georgi, that would be called a mass term. And an unparticle we saw is a state created by a CFT operator. And an unparticle action we saw is the Legendre transformation of a holographic boundary action. So I have to say that I prefer Howard's language because there's fewer syllables. It's easier for me to say. But everything you could translate and sound very sophisticated. OK, so that's the end of exact CFTs. Any questions? So phenomenologists don't care about exact CFTs because we look at nature and it doesn't look conformal, really. Except in, we have to look at very special cases to make it look conformal. What we're interested in are broken conformal field theories. So why are those things interesting? So we saw what pure unparticles are, and by ADS CFT unparticle correspondence, that's exactly the same thing as an RS2 model. If you think of the RS2 model is where the extra dimension is an infinite ADS. So that's just ADS. But phenomenologists call ADS RS2. And we know that none of us are interested in RS2. So therefore, we're not interested in pure unparticles. That's a theorem. But if we put an IR cutoff in at the TEV scale, that turns RS2 into RS1. And there are thousands and thousands of papers on RS1. So evidently, we do care about RS1. And that means if we care about RS1, then we care about unparticles with some sort of cutoff. But if we were just translating RS1 into unparticles, that would not be interesting either. However, what we can do is come up with different types of IR cutoffs. And if we have a different type of IR cutoff, then we'll have a different type of LHC phenomenology. And I claim that I'm interested in that, so at least one of us is interested. So the simplest thing you can do is something that was invented for ADS-QCD. You put in a dilaton field that acts as a soft wall. Instead of putting in a hard wall at the TEV scale, you can have some scalar field that's growing with Z, and that acts as a soft wall. They chose a soft wall that would make the KK spectrum look more like a Reggie trajectory for their application. So here's how we would do that. Let's say that H represents our bulk Higgs field, and it's going to couple to some background field that has a VEV. And the scaling dimension of this field is going to be such that it grows like z squared. And I'm just choosing this profile because it makes all the calculations easy. Once we actually find evidence of non-trivial critical exponents, then we can go back and choose more general profiles if we care at that point. But since we don't have any evidence yet, it doesn't make sense to work that hard yet. We'll just choose the simplest thing. So if you solve the 5D bulk equation of motion now, adds one extra term from this. Basically, this is like a position-dependent mass term in the extra dimension. Because of the z squared, it enters just like p squared. And so you can see that the two-point function of the CFT operator It's just the same thing, but now p squared is replaced by p squared minus mu squared. And it's still to the funny scaling dimension, which is determined by this mass. So if we compare what the spectral densities look like, the pure unparticle, or RS2, or ADS, has a continuous spectrum that goes all the way down to zero mass. If we put in a hard TEV wall, then we get the RS1 spectrum of KK modes. So we have a tower of KK modes. And now if we put in this particular soft wall, we have the same continuous spectrum down to the scale mu. And then it's cut off. So we have nothing down here, and then a continuous spectrum above some threshold. So you guys are happy with that? At some point, someone's supposed to object. Come on, guys, object. OK, make it scarier. So let's write down the effective action for this thing. The effective action is the Higgs field in four dimensions with the inverse propagator sandwiched between. We'll get to the potential later. And we can Fourier transform back to position space, so that's clearly a non-local operator that you can think of as this derivative to a funny power acting on a delta function. So we have non-local actions. Now you're supposed to object. But we just saw that this non-local action is equivalent to unparticles, which is equivalent to ADS, which is equivalent to CFT. So everything's kosher. Except when we want to put in gauge interactions now, our Higgs has to couple to SU2 cross U1. So you might be a little worried about that. But that problem was solved in 1962 by Mandelstam. He invented path-ordered exponentials of gauge fields, I believe when Wilson was still in kindergarten then. So Wilson was a genius, and Mandelstam is an underappreciated genius. So he invented these path-ordered exponentials so that he could write down a theory of gauge-invariant electrons. And this is sort of the same trick that people who do SCET use nowadays. So he invented SCET too. So we just take our not, we have some non-local term in the action. We put a path-ordered exponential in so that between the two fields, the combination is all gauge-invariant now. And then we're set to go. We just need to expand out this exponential and calculate the Feynman rules. So here is the first term, single gauge boson. You expand that thing out and resum the powers of momentum. You get this expression, which its form is obvious. If you think about it, first of all, when delta goes to 1, then you'll get p plus q squared minus p squared, which gives you 2p dot q plus q squared, so it cancels this denominator. This is the ordinary tree-level Feynman rule for a scalar coupling to a gauge boson. So that's good. You could also, if you thought about the Ward Takahashi identities, you'd remember that if you contracted q into this vertex, you should get some inverse propagators, one for each of the legs. So one leg had momentum p, one leg had momentum p plus q, and these are just the inverse propagators that we saw before, one with the momentum p and one with momentum p plus q. So you could have guessed this from the Ward Takahashi identity without knowing Mandelstam's fancy trick. So now we can write down a full model. So that what I just said is equivalent to putting in gauge covariant derivatives. That would be another way of doing it. So that, or alternatively, that's a shorthand for putting in the path-ordered exponential. And we'll add a potential, and I'm going to add this extra term so that when the momentum goes to 0, this cancels this. So this is what's left over in the momentum goes to 0 limit, so it's actually a potential. And then we can also add Yukawa couplings to fermions. Because the Higgs has scaling dimension delta, we need a suppression by some cutoff to the power delta minus 1 so that this is a dimension 4 term. And we'll assume that our potential, we don't know the form of it, but we'll assume it has some minimum with a BEV. And so far, the LHC has not measured anything beyond the quadratic terms in the potential. So for now, all we need is the Taylor expansion out to second order, which is... How is this different from walking Technicolor? We're going to see that it has a light Higgs. So my understanding of walking Technicolor is that there's no Higgs, but maybe there's some extended definition of Technicolor that it's Technicolor plus a magically light scalar that looks like a Higgs, then yes, then it would look like that, I guess. But that's not what Bob taught me. Bob taught me there was no Higgs in Technicolor.
Well,
now there is. Oh, did he say that? Did he say there's a Higgs in Technicolor? Okay. Yeah, so since we've only measured the mass term, we'll only really need the mass term from there. So that means we can calculate the propagator now. So because of these extra quadratic terms, there's one extra piece, and we'll lump them together and just call that parameter m. So there's our full propagator. So it has the CFT broken by a threshold, but you can also see that it has a pole. So part of the motivation is that this is sort of the minimal parameterization that allows you to have everything we need. We need a pole because we found a Higgs, and if we want to have non-trivial critical exponents, we need some threshold with a cut. So we need two mass scales to do that, and this model has that. And if you're good at complex analysis, you can see that you can take this and with some contour integrals, write it like this in terms of the spectral density again. And there's a pole piece, and plus whatever's left over gets lumped into some spectral density. But the spectral density only is non-zero above the scale mu, where the cut starts. So you can see that this is not going to be, this could be close to the standard model if we choose the parameters correctly, because we already have the Higgs pole there. If we look in more detail, you can see that after some rescaling to make things look canonically normalized, this residue will look like this mess here. But if we expand it out for large mu or delta close to 1, the leading correction vanishes when delta goes to 1, because when delta goes to 1, it's just an ordinary four-dimensional scalar. And when mu goes to infinity, the threshold is gone. So again, we should get the standard model back. So we can approach the standard model in two limits. Scaling dimension goes to 1, or threshold goes to infinity. So we're doubly safe in some ways. So any questions about the model? Yep. That was the Lagrangian. This is the Lagrangian. I can, by tuning this potential, I can change the Higgs BEV to 0 and go to a normal phase, and it has a critical exponent appearing in the kinetic term. So it's a parameterization of critical phenomena. Yes.
I can't see well enough, but is there a Higgs potential?
That's this thing here.
It's still important.
Right now, it's an arbitrary function. We'll just assume that it has a minimum, and we'll Taylor expand around that. But if you could put in a standard quadratic plus quartic, if you wanted to. Well, I'm assuming that there's, I'm allowing for explicit breaking of conformal symmetry. So I've already put in this scale mu, and I'm allowing another scale from the potential. So I have two sources of explicit breaking of conformal symmetry. And the motivation is that I want to have a pole and a cut, and I want them to be, I need two parameters, one for the pole, one for the cut.
How well separated?
You mean from an underlying theory or from playing around with this, they're arbitrary. If I had the four-dimensional CFT, then some lattice person could tell me how far apart I can take them. I mean, if mu is bigger than a TEV, then it's not interesting, at least for phenomenology, because we won't be able to probe it. Yes, but it's already a tuned theory because we're close to this quantum critical point. So we already assumed it was tuned somehow magically to get a light Higgs. So it's all, even without taking mu large, it's already tuned. If mu is bigger than the TV, then we just don't care about this theory, I would say. Well, the motivation is if we found a non-trivial critical exponent for the Higgs, then we would know that there's new physics beyond the standard model, and then we could hope that that new physics tells us how it's not really fine-tuned. It only looks fine-tuned from the low-energy effective theory. If mu goes to infinity, then there's some additional tuning in the underlying theory that we don't know what that theory is. So there's already a tuning in the effective theory because we're saying the Higgs is light, because it still has quadratic, well, it doesn't quite have quadratic divergences. I'll come back to that. Yep. For now, yes. Just to keep things simple. But first, I wanted to convince you that working with non-local gauge theories is not as scary as it sounds. And first, I'll show you something scary and then reassure you that it's not scary. So if I expand out that Lagrangian to get the second order term in the gauge fields, so this vertex, what you find is this big mess. So let's take it slowly. So you have, this is the term that you would have in the standard model, right? That would be the Higgs coupling to two gauge bosons. And when the Higgs gets a BEV, that's what gives the W mass. So you can read off the W mass from here, and you can see how the V of this quantum critical Higgs relates to the standard model V. This mess here is what we would call V squared in the standard model. Now, gauge invariance looks problematic here because if I contracted Q into this amplitude, this guy would cancel against that guy. That sounds nice, but then this piece is left over. So it would seem like we've broken gauge invariance. But what we've actually done is forgot to include all the diagrams. That's usually the answer when you think you've broken gauge invariance. So we haven't done any gauge fixing yet, so there's still a gauge boson, Goldstone boson mixing. So if you pick out the Goldstone boson mixing terms with the gauge field, it's just that same vertex we calculated before, but now one of the Higgs is sets to its BEV. And so it has zero momentum, so that vertex reduces to this when I set up in that former example to zero. Okay, and now, because of that vertex, there's an extra contribution to the W two-point function. So we have to include this if we want a gauge invariant result. There's a piece where the gauge boson mixes with the Goldstone boson. That will include an extra Goldstone boson propagator, And there'll be two factors of that vertex function. Now, if you go back to our Lagrangian, we'll know that there won't be any terms from the potential that contribute to the Goldstone boson, because it's these guys are associated with the gauge symmetry. So we'll just get the potential independent terms appearing in the Goldstone propagator. And then you'll see that this Goldstone boson propagator cancels one of these vertex factors. And then what's left exactly cancels this extra funky piece here. So the combination of the two diagrams is gauge invariant. Okay, another thing Higgs is supposed to do, aside from giving the W a mass, it's supposed to fix up WW scattering. So if you calculate in the standard model WW scattering without including the Higgs, you get an amplitude that grows with S. So unitarity will be violated eventually. And famously in the standard model, the Higgs comes in and cancels that growing behavior. But now that will not work because our Higgs propagator is softer. So we get a factor of energy from each longitudinal W, so that will give us S squared. Then we'll get S to the minus delta from the Higgs propagator. So it will only cancel when delta equals 1. So it looks like we've messed up again. But we know that the thing that ensures unitarity in the standard model is gauge invariance. That's what makes the couplings match up to do the cancellation. And we assured ourselves that it's gauge invariant, so there is another diagram. And that's because when we expand out our path-ordered exponential, there's a coupling of two Higgses to four Ws. That will also contribute to the scattering. And when you calculate that vertex, you find that there's a piece that exactly cancels that Higgs propagator, and there's a term linear in S which cancels the growth in the amplitude. And when delta goes to 1, this cancels against that. So in the standard model, this vertex is not there. So gauge invariance saves us again. You can also worry about, there's also a finite term at amplitude that can't get too big. But you probably can't read these numbers. It's going, mu goes from 100 to 800 here. And scaling dimension goes from 1 to 1.9, I think. We need the partial wave amplitude to be less than 1, and that gives you some constraint on mu and m. But these numbers, m has to be less than 1,000 here or 2,000 there. So there's only, the constraints are only significant when the scaling dimension gets close to 2. That's the only place where there's a significant constraint. And probably we're thinking, since the Higgs looks fairly standard model-like, probably delta is down below 1.5 at least, I would think. Back to the little hierarchy problem that Savas raised. Since the Higgs has dimension delta, it can't have a quadratic divergence. Because the divergence times Higgs squared should be dimension 4. So the biggest divergence we can get is the cutoff to the 4 minus 2 delta. So this is sort of another way of saying how it's related to Technicolor. In Technicolor, you solve the hierarchy problem. So you would say that delta is bigger than 2. And here we're talking about delta less than 2. So it's not like Technicolor in that sense. So you still have some divergence, but it's softened. You can see how that works trivially from the top loop, because this was a higher dimension operator. It comes with an extra suppression, so you get the scaling. So you might have hoped that this could solve the little hierarchy problem, but you only get some mileage out of it once you get up to scaling dimensions of 1.6 or 1.7. So I'm doubting that this actually will help. Okay, precision electric measurements. These guys calculated the precision electric measurements using the full five-dimensional calculation. And over here, you see something very close to the standard model Higgs. That's the usual S. This is S and T going up. That's the usual curve that you see in the particle data group and everywhere else. As you crank up the scaling dimension, what you see is that these guys squeeze up. So these are the guys that are problematic. So raising the scaling dimension just makes it better. And actually, with the observed Higgs mass, we're already down here anyway. So this moves it slightly. S gets slightly more negative, but not by significant amount compared to the measurements. So there shouldn't be any problem with precision electric measurements.
One question I have, so very late. So the Higgs, you have the full, right, and some spectral that's started from the nucleus. What about the Goldsteins, the original parts of that?
They also have a threshold at mu. So you can see that back.
So that does not.
It has. You have to use this propagator when you do the calculations. Yeah. So it makes a small correction to top decay.
So when the longitudinal parts are getting modified.
Yeah.
So there is not very precise, but the flavor curve, right? Because the Z pendant, for example, goes through the longitudinal part of the that part gets modified.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That'll be good to calculate. Okay, I think we're here. So we're almost at the end. So I tried to justify why this propagator makes sense from an ADS boundary action. And so we're saying this is a reasonable propagator. It passes some zeroth order tests. Gives a W mass, WW scattering, precision electroweak. The question is, if delta is not too far from one and mu is bigger than 300 GeV, how do we see the difference between this and that? That's the real question. And amazingly enough, even though we tell our students in field theory class that detectors only measure particles on shell, what we want to do here is measure the off-shell behavior of this propagator. And amazingly enough, LHC experimentalists, with some help from theorists, can already do that. The way that you do that is to look at an interference effect. So take two gluons, make a top loop, which goes to a Higgs, which goes to two Zs, which go to E plus E minus. You can start with the same initial state and the same final state by just going directly through a top loop. And because there's a interference here, you can, if there's a deviation in this propagator, you can see it showing up. So CMS and Atlas have already done preliminary measurements of this. You'll recall that there was some upward fluctuation from the standard model, which they put the spin on it that allowed them to get a four times better upper bound on the width than they expected to get. But also, it's some hint of possible new physics, equally. So it's not statistically significant at this point, but there is some excess. And if we calculate what would happen with a quantum critical Higgs with some particular parameters, 400 GeV for the threshold, scaling dimension 1.5, you see that there's a large deviation once you get above the threshold. So with enough data right now, there's no events down here. This is the interesting region to see what's going on. But with more data, there'll be, well, if it was this big, then you would start to see events out there. You could also, it would also be worth looking at the where one of the Zs goes to jets. So then you get a much bigger rate. The difference between the two is smaller, but you have more events. So it's at least worth looking at. So there's no more questions? I'm going to, yep. They'll be able to put bounds on in the mu and delta plane. If delta is 1.05, then they probably can't see the difference. But certainly, if it's 1.5, they can see the difference. So they'll get some bounds. So we'll be able to quantitatively say how close we are constrained to be like the standard model. So conclusions. The electroweak phase transition seems to be very, 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 very close to a quantum critical point. And the LHC can test whether the Higgs has non-trivial critical exponents. Thanks.
So I have a question.
Yeah?
About the phenomenology. So I imagine if you just take the standard model and it's supplemented by higher dimensional operators, and there are a lot of different configurations you can get. Is there any clear way that you could distinguish this particular signature from just, say, one of those operators that contributes to the UV scattering? So it'd be nice to say, okay, this is definitely a signature of having critical exponents.
So what's the operator you want to add?
Well, any of the dimension six that have covariant derivatives, which could be coupling to these, modify the Higgs. I'm not sure. It might be that this modifies in such a way you have to have some weird linear combination of higher dimensional operators, in which case it would be convincing. I'm just wondering whether you've looked at that.
No.
Other questions? I have another one. I know that there are some people who work on conformal bootstrap techniques to try and put bounds on the scaling dimensions of the Higgs squared term relative to the individual ones. Do those apply to these models at all?
No, because we're assuming that this Higgs is, so the Higgs is made of some strongly interacting stuff, but the Higgs interaction is weak. So we implicitly assume that the dimension of H squared was twice the dimension of H. So we're well within their bounds. To say it more explicitly, you can't rule that out because free field satisfies that scaling.
Yeah, exactly.